Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Being a farmer. Many people dream of being a farmer. Sure, the work is hard and the weather unpredictable. But living close to the land, creating healthy food, maybe organically, locally, sounds like heaven to a lot of people. Then why is the suicide rate among farmers the highest of all major occupations, double that of veterans? And it's not just the result of factory farming. In India, for example, where farming is mainly done in small farms, the old-fashioned way, just since 1995, get this, 270,000 farmers have committed suicide. What's going on? To help us understand, my guest is Mike Roseman. He is a farmer who has farmed corn, soybeans, oats, hay, purebred cattle, chickens, turkeys, and for 40 years, he's been a psychologist specializing in farmers. Mike Roseman, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what are the what kind of explanations are there for the extraordinarily high worldwide farmer suicide rate?
Well, we don't know every answer to that question, Marty, but we think that farmers are very attached to the land because they feel like they must work the land properly in order to make it produce food, which is an essential for life. Additionally, now we're producing more and more fibers for clothing and for shelter because we include lumber harvesters as part of the agricultural population. And more we're producing biofuels. But the urge to produce these essentials for life has made it a burden for farmers to retain the land on which they can produce these substances. And I think that is the crux of the problem. I call it the agrarian imperative. It's a theory that says that just like animals are territorial and acquire the most desirable territories in which to raise their young of the same species, humans have acquired territories to raise the food and the fibers and the renewable fuel that is needed for humans to survive. First of all, the family, then the community, but people at large throughout the entire world. When there is a threat to losing the land, we go to great lengths to hang on to it. Just like animals will fight to retain their territories, many wars have been fought among humans over desirable pieces of land. So that urge to hang on to the land and other resources like water and machinery and livestock and even the working capital, those become a life and death struggle in which farmers will put their lives on the line just to hang on to those assets that are needed to farm.
Those sound like multi-generational farmers who have been on the land for an awful long time. We're here in the San Francisco Bay Area where there is quite a movement over the last 5 to 10 years where people who were, you know, urbanites who were either sick of the traffic, the crime, just the pace of the distance where you buy your fruits and vegetables sometimes in plastic wrap, and who also were taken by the organic local sustainable movement, left San Francisco to move to, you know, farm country not very far away. Would they have different kind of motivations for committing suicide, or would those be the same somehow? Do they get quickly attached to the land?
We think that they are the same kind of motivations, Marty. There are two major types of agricultural operations in our country. We have the larger conventional operations that specialize in one or two crops like corn or maybe grapes for wine or wheat. But these farmers are becoming fewer and fewer while farming more and more land. The alternative farmers, and that's a term that's used, is alternative farming, is generally, it includes organic farmers, smaller farmers like you described, and by the way, it's not just in San Francisco where we have a great many people who farm as a lifestyle of choice. They do it because their heart is partly into the soil and working the land and living with nature. That, I think, is part of the agrarian imperative also.
Is that was so that's one cause, this the sense of urgency and desperation to hold on to their land and do a good job of farming, even despite some bad weather or whatever, certainly to avoid mistakes in watering, feeding, pesticide construction, pesticide control, fungicide control. But is there another widely held cause for the enormous suicide rate among farmers?
Well, besides the intense attachment to the land, there are several other factors. One of the things that we almost always see prior to someone taking his or her own life, and by the way, men are four times more likely to end their lives by suicide than women on the farm. But other causes or contributing factors are the use of farm pesticides. Certain types of insecticides in particular have repercussions that are similar to what happens to the insect that either ingest the insecticide or absorbs it because they've actually touched the spray that's been put on the plants. The insecticide renders the insect unable to function by speeding up the transmission of nervous signals in their insect nervous systems. The same thing happens to humans who have experienced a toxic level of exposure to insecticides. And these are especially insecticides in three categories: the organophosphates, carbamates, and then the neonicotinoids. We don't know as much about the latter, that is the neonicotinoids, because they've not been around as long and we don't have the solid research database that we have with the other types of insecticides.
Am I naive to, I mean, I thought that there are really stringent rules that, you know, a farmer knows that they've got to put breathing equipment on, a mask or whatever, and, you know, a Tyvek or whatever it is to avoid the skin contact. Is it that that farmers are just, they're more free-spirited than that and then just say, oh, screw it, or is there something else going on?
Well, there's actually something more going on, Marty. Farmers generally are fairly careful about how they take precautions when handling controlled substances like insecticides. First of all, they have to pass a course to become certified as an applicator if they apply these insecticides themselves. So they learn about the dangers, and they learn how to use personal protective equipment like rubber gloves or sometimes masks and even respirators. But what happens with most of the insecticides is that they accumulate in our body systems. The insecticides attach to fat cells. We have a difficult time eliminating them from our bodies. The body tries very hard to do that by frequent urination, sweating, mucus flow, tearing, even vomiting. But it's very difficult to eliminate a toxic exposure to the poisonous substance, whether it has been ingested or breathed in or absorbed through the skin. However it gets into the body is not as important as the amount that accumulates in our body.
Right.
And it takes several weeks to gradually lower that level to a safe threshold.
You had mentioned almost in passing, almost like a throwaway line, you said that four times as many male farmers die of suicide than females. I mean, that is 400% as high. I've never heard that at all. And frankly, when doing the research for the show, I read an NPR. There was a big NPR story about it, and there's all kinds. And nowhere is that mentioned. What? First of all, why do you think it's not mentioned? And secondly, why do you think four times as many men as women farmers? By the way, 30% of farmers are women. That I did look up and find. What's the explanation for the gargantuan difference between the male and female farmer suicide rate?
We can look to two public health researchers by the name of Singh, S-I-N-G, and Siaposh, S-I-A-H-P-U-S-H. They looked at the rate of farmer suicide according to the degree of urbanization or rural life in which people lived. They compared the most rural settings where most farming and ranching are done with the most urban, and found that the rate of suicide among farmers over a 20-year period ending in approximately 1997, they found that the rate of rural suicides in general was about 60% higher. Now, that includes farmers and ranchers, but many other people who also live in rural. Singh and Siaposh postulated that there's something about farming that makes people tend to take their lives when things aren't working out economically. They also looked at the gender of persons who ended their lives, and that's where we get the data that clearly specifies that men are four times more likely than females to end their lives by suicide. That's partly due also to the fact that men are more likely to use lethal methods. They tend to use guns as the primary method, followed by hanging, whereas females tend to use less lethal methods, such as overdose and cutting blood vessels.
It doesn't quite, I mean, explain a 400% difference. Is there any credible hypothesis as to why male farmers commit suicide at 400% the rate of females?
Well, the only information that I can add to what I've already said is that just like the males in most animal species are the most aggressive and do much of the fighting over the territories, I think males in the human species feel a strong urge to have to supply the food and the materials necessary to produce a lifestyle that makes human beings multiply successfully and happily.
It's remarkable to me, when women have the deficit, for example, we're underrepresented in engineering and there's no life and death involved.
Yeah.
You see, we've over the last decade or two seen billions of dollars in massive redress, so that now there's more women, or at least certainly 50% of women in college, in medical school, in law school. And yet here we have this enormous suicide difference in male and female, and I haven't even heard of it.
Well, it's pretty much endemic to the agricultural population, not to all other occupations. So the greater rate of people taking their own lives is highest in the agricultural occupation. We know that from data released from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. These data came out in July of 2016. We also know from a study undertaken by Dr. Wendy Ringenberg and her associates at the University of Iowa that looked at what kind of workplaces were associated with suicide. Dr. Ringenberg and her associates found that suicide was much more common in the agricultural workplace than any other workplace. Independent validation that suicide is connected to the occupation of farming, and again, both Ringenberg and the CDC find higher rates of self-destruction among males than females.
I don't know,
especially
anything
in the agricultural occupation.
I don't know anything about farming, but I do know, General, I'm a career counselor, and I've been doing this radio show for 28 and a half years.
Sure.
So I am familiar with workplace deaths by gender and other all kinds of characteristics. 93% of all workplace deaths occur to men. 98% of all deaths in the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., have been men. So it's certainly not limited to agriculture.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to listen or let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Mike Roseman. He is a farmer for 40 years and a psychologist specializing in farmer problems. And I want to turn now to solutions. You know, the problem is pretty frightening. What kind of solutions have been most successful in reducing the rate of farmer suicide?
The most successful solutions have been educating farmers about managing our behavior. That means looking out for our neighbors, but also looking out for ourselves. We know that some farmers, most farmers become overly threatened when weather is bad for planting or harvest, or there's a disease outbreak, or economic times are tough because markets are low. We know that those conditions threaten the well-being of farmers, so they go to great lengths to deal with the threat. They work extra hard. They take risks that they probably wouldn't take otherwise, sometimes by working excessive hours, foregoing sleep. We know that sleep deprivation impairs our judgment, and that about 10 hours of sleep debt is similar to what would happen to our reactions if we had 0.08 alcohol in our blood. So sleep deprivation is a contributing factor, and it especially occurs during planting and harvest seasons, which are the major times when suicide is likely to occur among the farm population.
You talked about two causes, and at the risk of this, you know, this segment being so depressing, there is, I think, room for hope in two areas, and I'm curious what you think, because I'm just looking at this from afar.
Yeah.
But in terms of even weather, which we don't think we can control very much, I've been reading about satellite data. New satellite data combined with artificial intelligence is going to enable farmers to predict longer term what crops are likely to be okay for the coming months. Is that something that gets talked about in farmland?
That kind of information is being talked about now because farmers are looking for any way they can to maximize profitability. So turning to technology is especially common in agricultural endeavors. Both the conventional style of large farming and the specialized, more organic approaches. All of these farmers are keenly aware of how to maximize yields to improve profitability. So, yes, they do use such things now as telephones, which keeps them in touch with other persons if the tractor tips over and they're able to use their telephone. But that's both a good and a bad thing, having an electronic device. Farmers were not raised in previous generations to know how to deal with such things as contract development, and they often lacked adequate social skills in negotiating bargains and contracts and talking about themselves and their own turmoil. So now we have a digital age in which those skills are necessary and are practiced. Many farmers aren't ready for this. I would say, though, that farmers will use confidential telephone hotlines and resources that they can pick up through reading in agricultural publications, in community workshops, in courses. They're very open, for the most part, to obtaining information to make themselves safer and better farmers.
I want to talk a little bit about, you talk about profit and price and contracts. I want to talk about a little bit about farm subsidies because of the thin profits. But I also need to talk about this. The assumption in what you said was, and I'm curious if you have data, is that talking it out, whether it be with a suicide hotline or fellow farmers or family members, is a good thing. I can never get out of my head a New York Times report a few years ago about teenage girls, of all things, that said that the more they talked out their problems, the more unhappy they were. Is there good data that supports farmers talking it out actually causally linked to reduced suicide and increased happiness?
Well, we do know that when we operated farm crisis telephone services here in the Midwest during the farm crisis of the 1980s, and when farmers participated in counseling, it reduced the suicide rate. And we know that farm crisis hotlines followed up with counseling from professionals who understand agriculture as well as behavioral health. We know that these approaches help farmers to make the necessary changes in their personal adjustments and in their thinking that reduces their vulnerability to suicide. So there's pretty good data about that, enough data that the National Register of Evidence-Based Best Practices considered these telephone hotlines and counseling from farmers or from counselors familiar with agrarian culture, that we know that those approaches helped.
Okay, that's reassuring, and I appreciate that. You had made a number of allusions to the profit issue, and of course, one of the things that has been done for many years in this country is farm subsidies. And something I'm just curious about, I was wondering about, you know, I would probably enjoy being an organic tomato farmer somewhere here near where I live. But if I did even a most modest amount of due diligence, I would realize it's a mature market. It's like if I wanted to run a yoga studio now, it seems like there's a yoga studio under every corner. If I choose to open a yoga studio or grow organic tomatoes near here in the San Francisco Bay Area and I lose money, is it fair of me to say, hey, well, I've got the taxpayer, you know, supporting me?
Well, you raise a good point. The latest farm bill that we're operating under right now does include many crops that were not included under federal crop insurance provisions prior to the latest farm bill. But now such things as vineyards, even cattle herds, dairy herds, the production of fruits and vegetables and nuts, those are all recognized farm products that are available for insurance protection, just like wheat, corn, soybeans, potatoes, and so forth. So crop insurance has made farming less riskier financially, but the insurance only pays up to the amount that is invested in the crop production. It does not subsidize the needs of a household to continue to maintain itself. So there has to be some outside source of income to offset or to supplement what crop insurance might cover during a disaster. Plus, not all farmers seek 100% coverage. They may elect coverage that is at a level anywhere from 10% up to 100%. It's a calculated risk that farmers take. But I would say that the solution is not in improving crop subsidies or insurance. It is in taking care of the most important asset in the food production chain, and that is the people who produce the food. That's why we need educational programs, telephone and digital emergency services that can be accessed at any time, day or night, and which are staffed by responders who understand agriculture and the particular problems that farmers are having. Just like veterans want to talk to other military people on veterans' hotlines, farmers want to talk to people who understand agriculture.
Makes sense. A listener has just written in at the top of the show, for those of you just joining us. I should let our listeners know. I'm talking to Mike Roseman. He is a longtime farmer as well as a psychologist specializing in the problems of farming. And we're talking about the enormous suicide rate. And at the top of the show, I talked about it being a worldwide problem. And so the caller, is the listener, is asking, and you may not know this, you're not expected to know about suicide among farmers worldwide, but he asks, is the rate of suicide among farmers in India higher than farmers in the rest of the world?
No, it's not. It's actually lower than farmers in the rest of the world, but it's higher than any other occupation in India. And that kind of bubble burst of suicides that began 5 or 6 years ago surprised the Indian health ministry. They weren't prepared to see how many farmers were ending their lives. But it turns out that they ended their lives for many of the same reasons that imperil farmers in America. That is, large farmers were squeezing out the small family farmers that had small plots. They weren't able to hang on to a family plot and felt like they had lost the family heritage that their ancestors had worked hard to operate and sustain. They also, in many cases, began using insecticides in the families that I described earlier without adequate knowledge about using personal protective devices like latex gloves and masks. So those factors were major contributors, or at least they were correlates for the high suicide rate among Indian farmers.
We're just about out of time. Like I've mentioned a couple of times, you've been at this, both the farming deal, not only deal, for the farming enterprise activity, whatever, as well as being mm-hmm. a psychologist specializing in farming for a long time. What's next for Mike Roseman?
What's next for me?
Yeah.
I would love to see the creation of a national network of behavioral health supports for the agricultural people in our country. Mm. We could do a lot to improve the stability of food production if we have healthy farmers, and if we are able to provide a support system that deals with the emotional stress, we will be taking care of, like I said earlier, we'll be taking care of the most important asset in food production, and that's the people.
Indeed. Well, you are certainly an eloquent spokesperson. Let me ask you that. Is there, if somebody wanted to contact you or some entity you want to share that would, you know, be of help to farmers, what would you recommend, what website or phone number would you recommend that they contact?
Well, people can find me on the Internet. If you Google or do an online search with the words Agrarian Imperative Roseman, R-O-S-M-A-N-N, you'll find information. Otherwise, you can look up a website that is called Ag Behavioral Health, www.ag, and then the words behavioral, B-E-H-A-V-I-O-R-A-L, health, H-E-A-L-T-H.com. So it's www.agbehavioralhealth.com.
And Mike Roseman, thank you very much for staying up late. You're in the Midwest, and you farmers go to bed early, so I'm particularly honored that you would stay up late for us.
Well, thank you for bringing attention to this important circumstance.
It's my pleasure indeed. Thanks, and sleep well. Take care, Mike.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now we turn to you. You're my priority. If we do what are called workovers, we is perhaps a royal we, that's inappropriate. I do workovers on callers. If you've got a work-related problem, this is my pro bono work. I get paid reasonably during the week to do it, but I come here because I care about doing it for you. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, this is the time to call before lines fill up. Doesn't matter your age or, as they say, your station in life. Forgive that for being a pun about radio. But whether you're unemployed, well-employed, unhappy is the common denominator. If you're unhappy about anything related to your work life or that of someone you love, my job is to at least help you take a baby step toward happiness and success. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I am very grateful to my listeners, and I make a point of saying that at the end of the show, not only because of your calls, but I frequently get emails or articles or whatever, and one of my longtime listeners is a librarian named Mark Mackler, and he sent me a wonderful article about Bloomberg from Bloomberg that's very timely. Right now is the time when people are deciding, certainly in the private colleges, where to apply, and quite soon they're going to be deciding whether they should go or not. And this is kind of a book review of a brand new book by an economist named Brian Kaplan. So I'm going to read you a little excerpt from this article from Bloomberg about this book. Anyone who's been to college has to have some qualms about its value. Anatomy is essential if you're going to be a doctor, and history if you plan to teach Western Civ, but most of us don't need to understand the Krebs cycle or the Peloponnesian War. Honestly, how much do you remember, let alone use from Spanish or chem or calculus? For many students, college is mostly about jumping through hoops on command to show potential employers you're ready, willing, and able to jump through hoops on command. High school isn't much different. As someone named B. Dillon, 234, tweeted on January 11th, quote, I feel like my whole high school education, but especially math, was like, okay, pretend that Google doesn't exist. How would you do X? A forthcoming book by economist Brian Kaplan takes whatever misgivings you had about education and cranks the amplifier up to 11. Kaplan's new book, it's called The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. It is, this is now the reviewer says, it's tenaciously argued and thoroughly documented with 42 pages of notes and 44 pages of references. He then says, the standard economic, kindergarten is when Kaplan begins to sense that something was wrong with education. By junior high school, he writes, he's learned to game the system, quote, working as little as possible to get A's in all the classes I deemed boring and useless. Whatever tricks he picked up seemed to have worked. He earned a bachelor's degree from the University of California, Berkeley, a PhD from Princeton, and a tenured job as a professor at George Mason University. The standard economics case for education is that it, quote, builds human capital, skills, knowledges, and habits that are valuable in the workplace. More human capital benefits both students and the economy, but Kaplan argues that human capital isn't the main story. He concedes that everyone needs to learn how to read, write, and do basic math, but that most of what people learn in high school and college is unnecessary and quickly forgotten. On the international level, he cites studies finding no correlation between a country's education level and its national income, holding all other factors equal. He then writes, I'm going to try to skip. I think this is going to get a little long. I'm going to stop here because it's too long. But what I'd like to do is certainly invite you to be the free thinker that we all here in the Bay Area hope that we are. Of course, many people should go to college, to graduate school, but especially now, ever more, as you know, we send the highest percentage of high school graduates to college in history, 70%. And we have a mammoth, the Bay Area has the highest percentage of college graduates. Employers are no longer using a college degree as much to signal, oh, this is a smart, hardworking, knowledgeable person, because there's been huge grade inflation. There are, the student bodies are weaker at most colleges, not at Stanford or Berkeley, but at many other schools. And so if you are somebody, or your child or your relative is somebody who you sense is going to blow college off, because the average student spends 2.76 hours per week studying. That's it. And the dropout rate is enormous in most colleges. If you sense that your kid's going to be one of them, rather than going into this enormous debt, is it possible that your son or daughter might, or you, might be well off to do your learning in the real world through a formal or informal apprenticeships, through self-study or whatever, and then if by any chance, not any chance, if that doesn't work, you can always go back to the school route. Anyway, the phone number here, if you'd like a workover, any kind of work-related problem, 415-841-4134. What's that the number of? Work with Marty Namco and KALW. 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, am I live?
You are.
Well, hello there. I love your show, and I'm a long-time listener. My name is Leslie Landberg.
Hi, Leslie.
I don't have any issues with trying to find work. I'm a happy productive entrepreneur from an entrepreneurial family.
Yay.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention really quickly that I am familiar with the issue of the 240,000 people who committed suicide in India. And I was dismayed to hear that your guest did not mention the role of BT Cotton and Monsanto in those deaths, because by and large they all drank the insecticide that had been supplied by Monsanto. And one of Monsanto's infamous talking points is that when people and livestock and crops fail or they die as a result of using the product, it's because of improper use. But I assure you they were all using it properly when they got catastrophically ill. And those crops were worthless, and they couldn't unload them on the market. And successful farmers who had been in business with no issues for years all went belly up, and Monsanto bought all of that land for 10 cents on the dollar. That's what happened to all those folks.
I really appreciate you bringing it up. You know, I apparently you were the person who sent in a text or an email. Is that right?
That was not me. It wouldn't surprise me. This is fairly common knowledge in people who are aware of the issues with Monsanto.
I see. Somebody else did, and the first question that the person had asked, they wanted to talk about Monsanto, but the first question they asked is the rate of suicide in India higher? And when the guest, who's really quite an expert, said no, it's lower, I didn't feel like I should go deeper into that, given that the overall rate is lower. But anyway, I deeply appreciate your call, and thank you very much.
Well, that's why I thought perhaps he might have been an apologist or a shill under the pay, but I couldn't find any indication on the internet.
No, he's not.
Before
I
called you,
he's a psychologist and a farmer for 40 years. That's what he's been doing. Anyway, thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Take care. I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. As it happened, I got this guy from NPR, from National Public Radio itself. So, you know, he has exquisite liberal credentials. Anyway, I want to 415-841-4134 is the number for a workover if you've got a work-related problem. I want to, you know, far from all wisdom resides with me. And there are two people who right now are considered kind of the, self-help gurus, both in the workplace and outside. One is Jordan Peterson and one is Adam Grant. Jordan Peterson is a Harvard PhD, taught at Harvard. Now he's at University of Toronto. And Adam Grant is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, the Ivy League school there. And they both offer some really wonderful tips. This Jordan Peterson guy has just written a book that is really top-selling now called 12 Rules for Life. And what was that book, 12 Rules for Life, had its genesis in 42 rules that he had listed earlier. And I read those 42, and about, maybe 15 of them evoked a reaction in me. Some were just agreement and amplification, and some were strong disagreement. And so I thought what I would do is I would read these 42 they're like one-liners to kind of synthesize what he has to say. So I thought I would read the 10 or so that are relevant to work that I resonated with or at least disagreed with, created a reaction. So you heard his position as well as mine. But I want to prioritize you, my dear listener, so I'm going to go to the phones first. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, my name is David.
Hello, David.
Hi, I have a question about non-compete agreements with employers.
Okay.
So I've been with my employer for 2 years. I signed a non-compete. I work in consulting. The non-compete basically says that I can't work for any organization for a period of a year for an organization that has a membership with my firm, and my firm has memberships with about 70% of organizations across the country. Over the last 6 months, my firm was acquired by a larger firm, and so I'm curious if my non-compete is still in play.
I'm not a lawyer. I'm not allowed to give legal advice. You may want to call your legal rights, but having said that, I am aware that a certain number of non-competes have been stricken simply because they were overbroad. And if indeed 70% of the companies that are likely to hire you for the kind of work you do are would be covered under that, that may, and again, I'm not a lawyer, that may be seen as overbroad. And the extent to which when the contract is bought by a larger company, the extent to which the terms of the contract are still valid, I think would depend in part on the fine print in what your original contract was. If it said the terms of this thing apply if we are taken over by another company, that's one point in their favor. I don't know, but it certainly sounds like something that is enough of a gray area that it's probably worth an hour's or a half hour, because there could be significant money involved here, worth a consultation with an employment lawyer. And the one that just is, he's been around forever, he's expensive, but he has associates. Mark Rudy has R-U-D-Y has a certainly an excellent reputation. He may even have retired, but his firm is pretty solid gold in the plaintiff employment area, and that's what I would suggest to you.
Excellent, thank you.
You're very welcome. Okay. We've got calls on the line. I'll go back to the Jordan Peterson thing in a minute, but let's take a call or two. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Marty. So I'm calling about the question about college or no college.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like that your guest or you are advocating for young people who are not really inclined to go to college, not to go, and I'm questioning that because there's no other place where a young person can be with other people and search for what they are really interested in.
Okay, I want to interrupt you. Got the point. I'm thrilled you called. First of all, what I was doing was reading a small excerpt from an article about, it's a book review by an economist who was making the case. But I share some of that view, and I'd like to provide some more nuance. Of course, any time we talk about an individual decision, it depends on the kid. But I certainly can unequivocally say that there are other ways to figure out what you want to do than in college. And in fact, when you go to college, so much of what you learn is abstract and theoretical and not very related to the vast majority of careers, which is why so many people end up with careers having nothing to do with their majors. Also, because of the enormous cost now, $200,000 net cost, or at least total sticker price at a University of California, and $300,000 for 4 years at a private, it's an awfully expensive way to learn what may often be theoretical if you're talking about learning about what you want to be when you grow up. More concerning, or not, I shouldn't say more, but as concerning, when I hear about the huge dropout rate, and I'm not talking about Stanford that has a 95% graduation rate, or Berkeley that may have 75% graduation rate, but in the 20, for example, the 20 campus California State University system, I think it's maybe now 21, the 4-year graduation rate is under 20%. The 6-year graduation is under 30%. That means that 70 to 80% of people drop out with the assault of the self-esteem, still have the mountain of student debt. And so I can't reflexively anymore say just go to college. So depending on the kid, if the kid is burned out on school, as so many kids are when they graduate high school, and especially if they're headed toward a nearly open admission California State University school or a non-selective private, you know, I worry a lot about the parents' money. I worry about the kid learning theoretical stuff or not learning and cutting classes. So I feel it's important to give people the full range of options from apprenticeships to learning on the job to community college to standard 4-year college and what I call autodidacts. There's a certain percentage of people, some of the most successful people in the world, like the Bill Gateses and the Steve Cases who started AOL, and Barbara Streisand and Woody Allen and millions of others, who dropped out of college or never got a college degree and ended up becoming, they were able to free to study what they wanted rather than the Peloponnesian Wars, when they wanted, starting when they wanted, ending when they wanted, rather than showing up from, 8 to 10 every Tuesday morning, in room 243 and finding a parking spot. I feel like it's important, especially on public radio, where we're trying to broaden the conversations, to go beyond the standard conventional wisdom of everybody goes to college, to at least present the other side. And I thank you for the call. Okay. Now, back to Jordan Peterson. So again, Jordan Peterson is kind of the reigning self-help guru with a lot to say about work, and therefore it's appropriate for the show. And his book, true bestseller, 12 Rules for Life, was based on a Quora post where he listed 42 rules of life, of which 10 related to work I had a reaction to. And these 42 were kind of one-liners, so I'm going to read you his one-liner and then my response. He wrote, "Nothing well done is insignificant." My response, "But what about the opportunity cost? For example, people spend time primping a report or doing home repairs to unnecessary tolerances, not to mention perfecting their golf swing. Better advice, it seems to me, is to select the appropriate degree of care based on the opportunity cost. For example, would spending an extra hour polishing this report be a better use of my time than what I could otherwise be doing?" Another of Jordan Peterson's 42 points is, quote, "Set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world." Now, you could spend a lifetime trying to get your, quote, house in perfect order. And that's true whether it's literally a house, which is one of the things he mentioned. He said you got to have a perfect room. Or your personal behavior. That is, you know, don't criticize the world, when you are, for example, shooting from the hip and being unfairly assaulting on people. It would seem that better advice is to get started on trying to fix the world rather than waiting until you're perfect or even close to it. Of course, work on yourself, but get your personal house in order only sufficient enough for you to go out and make that difference. So that's, I think he's way wrong. Talk about bad grammar. He's deeply incorrect in saying set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. I have more of Jordan Peterson's rules, quote unquote, and my responses, but I would like to give out the phone number. If you need some work help of any sort, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko in KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Another of Jordan Peterson's rules is dress like the person you want to be. Well, I have a mixed reaction to that. Yeah, dressing the part can be a positive, self-fulfilling prophecy. You feel more like your aspired to self. And other people, lookist shallow species that we are, tend to treat you as you look. But too many people spend too much time on their veneer. You can gift wrap a bad product, it's still a bad product. Most of your focus should be on improving your substance, not your packaging, even if some foolish people get seduced by your appearance. Obviously, you want to aspire for quality, not hype. And it's maybe not so obvious because hype is increasingly the American way. Marketing is among the fastest growing occupations in America. Yuck. Now, those are some areas where I have significant disagreement with Jordan Peterson, but there are areas I have substantial agreement. For example, Jordan Peterson says, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today. Right, I agree. Keeping up with the Joneses, whether it's in terms of material acquisitions or in terms of career or avocationally, serves no purpose. Your benchmark should be, just as Peterson says, your benchmark should be you. Peterson says, imagine who you could be and then aim single-mindedly at that. Yeah, I basically agree. Most people, at least, must focus. I'm always nervous whenever they say always, these broad generalizations. Brilliant people can dabble and yet achieve significantly in multiple areas, but most people, yes, must focus. Jordan Peterson says, don't let bullies get away with it. I agree. We like to believe that kindness is repaid, but in the real world, many people are more likely to treat you fairly if you've invoked at least a measure of fear. That's true not just with bullies. If your boss or your romantic partner, your friend, knows that you're not going to take crap, they're more likely to treat you well. For example, taking a business example, a workplace example, let's say you're negotiating salary. Instead of following the standard advice to let the employer make the first offer, which is usually a low ball, on average, you're going to do better by firmly asserting that you need whatever it is, $85,000, you know, plus X and Y and Z. Jordan Peterson says, make at least one thing better for every single place you go. I agree. I'd probably phrase it a little more catchily. I'd say keep your antenna out for opportunities to make a difference. Okay, I want to give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about is unhappy at work, or you want to tell your story, I like workplace stories. Let's say something great happened to you at work, something crappy happened to you at work, your miserable boss, your wonderful boss, whatever it is, a workplace story or a workplace problem, I invite you to call here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415 841 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. More of Jordan Peterson's rules for living that are related to work. He says, pursue what is meaningful, not what's expedient. Obviously, that's true, but what's meaningful? Well, my definition of the life meaningfully led is spend as much time as possible using your best abilities toward meeting an under-addressed need that, if it were addressed, would make a big difference. Like, for example, tutoring gifted kids in a blue-collar school. Jordan Peterson's, another of Jordan Peterson's rules, ask someone to do you a small favor so that he or she can ask you to do one in the future. I agree, but another reason to ask for a favor is that it makes a person more likely to want to do favors for you. That's what's called commitment bias. The person wants to feel it was wise to have given you something, so he or she chooses to do more for you, which reinforces the so-called correctness of having bestowed the first favor. Jordan Peterson says, notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. Yeah, that's true. There rarely, fairly rarely at least, is a reason to be bored. So yeah, as he says, look for opportunities to do the most you can, not the least you can get away with. And when, as he says, when someone in authority has shirked, that's a particularly good opportunity for you to make a bigger difference than you otherwise might have. It's like if your boss is lazy doesn't produce very much, you may be able to step in and make a bigger difference than just doing your job. Now, I've got five of my own. Those are the areas of agreement and disagreement that I have with the self-help guru du jour, Jordan Peterson, has to say. But that triggered me to create five of my own rules related to one's work life. I call them the five contrarian rules related to one's work life, but I would like to, for the last time, give out the phone number. Want some work help? This is the time to do it. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. My five contrarian rules related to one's work life. Be judgmental. Discernment is one of Homo sapiens' most distinctive and valuable characteristics. It is core to what has enabled us to accomplish so much more than any other species. Yet today's ethos has fogged us into devaluing judgment. I heard somebody say recently, all music is worthy. It's merely a matter of perspective. I don't think that's true. I think most thoughtful listeners to music would agree that Beethoven's Ode to Joy is simply better than Eminem's Foolish Pride. One more. Be elitist. This is a corollary of the previous one. Spend your time and money on the people not necessarily who have the greatest deficit, but those with the greatest potential to profit. As every battlefield medic knows, if he or she wants to save the most lives, that person has to use their limited resources where they're likely to make the biggest difference. So, fight to work with people you respect. Hold out for relationships with people you deem to be really great. Donate your money to causes that have proven helpful to those with unusual potential to improve the world. I've got three more, but again, I want to prioritize you. So, back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi. Hi. Thanks for the show. I'm enjoying the tips.
My pleasure.
And the one on focusing kind of got my attention because I'm finding myself pulled in a lot of different directions. I have a day job that I love that pays the bills and also is mission-driven, so I don't have an existential crisis when things are hard at work. And I've always wanted to write fiction, so I have written a novel. Mm-hmm. It's sitting on my hard drive, and I'm at the point where I'm trying to either decide to self-publish or go the traditional route, which is harder. And then I'm also feeling like I need to respond to political events that are happening in the national scale that seem really hard to turn away from. And so I'm trying to do all of it.
Right.
And I feel like if I neglect my writing, I'm not bringing something into the world that needs to be out there. And then if I'm ignoring politics, I'm turning my back on a time of crisis in this country. And I also I'm torn between focusing and trying to do a little bit of everything.
Articulately said, and I love your call. So am I being simplistic and say the busiest people are the ones who are the happiest? We all manage to waste time on watching silly TV, chatting on the phone, going shopping, taking too long a bath or whatever. You have three awesome things that you're doing. Awesome! Your job sounds great, mission-driven and pays the bills. A novel that's already done. You're wanting to get involved in improving the nation. Well, there's got to be time for all of it. And you the perfect is the enemy of the good. What I would do would be, very quickly, I would identify 10 agents who would be appropriate for your kind of fiction. Send them the first chapter and a brief cover letter. Don't obsess. Don't be perfectionistic in the cover letter. Write a heartfelt half-pager and include the first chapter and perhaps an outline of the rest. And then that can be done pretty quickly. And then, yes, ask yourself, in the time and bandwidth you have, how could you spend 5 hours a week in the service of the political cause that you most believe in? And you will feel better about your life than if you try to choose two out of the three. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah.
And then, yes, most books don't sell. Look, I've had 10 books published. I've been lucky 4 of them have sold great, and 6 have sold squat. And I've been published a number of times by major publishers, but I've also had to self-publish. And you know what? I've been probably happier with the self-published ones, even though they didn't sell much at all, because I had complete control. I didn't feel like I was compromising. I felt authenticity. And I'm very proud of those books, even if they only sold 200 copies. So it is not like you're a loser if the agents say, no, this just doesn't resonate with me. Go and damn self-publish. Amazon CreateSpace makes it so easy, so awesome. Do write your novel. Get it. See, certainly you'll probably sell more if it gets sold to a major publisher. Or there's an intermediate step. Enter your maybe a short story version of it into contests. Because if you win a contest, enter 10 contests. You enter 10 contests, you get honorable mention even. Suddenly the agents are going to be much more interested in you. So go in all of those directions. In the arc of your life, you'll be glad you did it all. How do you really feel about what I just said?
I really am excited. Yeah, I'm glad I called. It's because I kept feeling like I should just do one and forget the others.
Nope.
And this allows me to kind of have an approach to all three.
Right. So. Not if you're my client or my sister. Whenever I have a client, I'm always asking myself, is this the advice I'd give my brother or sister? That is the advice I would give to my brother or sister or my wife. And it is my advice I give to you. And I give you a metaphorical hug and I say, go forth and conquer.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad I called.
Great. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemko. And what a lovely way to end the show. That is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. And like I said earlier, somebody emailed me, a great article that was worth sharing with you. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, I'm going to do a pre-Valentine's Day show. What about romance in the workplace in the time of hashtag Me Too? My wife, Barbara Nemko, and I are going to discuss the matter. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.